Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Don't look now, but there's something funny going on over there at the bank, George. I've never really seen one, but that's got all the earmarks of being a run.
Blue Monday, how are you, Blue Monday? Got to work, lack of sleep all day. Here come Tuesday.
It is the Savage Nation. There's an awful lot in the news. There's no bigger news than the failure of the bank, the big bank. You may say, well, it's not a big bank, and relatively it is not a big bank, but it's the second largest bank failure in American history. That makes it a very big bank, and it is the first but not the last of a sequence that we all know is coming. And the question to you is, given that we see a financial downturn, if you want to be a very mild personality, or if you'd rather be a little alarmist, you could say a financial collapse, what are you doing about it? What are you doing with your cash? Are you leaving it in a bank? Are you putting it under a mattress? Are you converting it to gold? Are you converting it to silver? You know, we went through a currency crisis of sorts in this country as near as 30 years ago, somewhat after the Vietnam War. It's because the war almost bankrupted us then, and the war has almost bankrupted us now if it hasn't already done so. But the more I look at this campaign, I see a pattern that has emerged, and that pattern is socialism. And I will tell you, there's not a bit of difference between the socialist Republicans and the socialist Democrats. I believe that Bush is the socialist leader of the very rich, and I believe Obama is the socialist leader of the very poor. Witness his speeches to La Raza and his speeches to the NAACP. I believe that they're both socialists. I know that there's no difference other than which demographic they're appealing to. We have Obama as the socialist leader of the very poor. We have Bush as the socialist leader of the very rich. Witness Bush's bailout of his friends on Wall Street through Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, and Bernanke, the Fed chairman. And if you look any further, you'll go back to the government media complex. And I'm calling today for an investigation and a possible indictment of the former federal chairman, Alan Greenspan, and his wife, Andrea Mitchell. And I'll tell you why I say that. I know you may say, why are you singling out Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Fed? The answer is because he let this happen. The answer is because sober minds on Wall Street were saying the ship's hitting an iceberg. The plates are coming off the hull. The rivets are popping. And he was saying, ah, sure, the free market will straighten it all out. Oh, let the free market rule. Oh, let the market correct itself. And they're saying, but the ship is taking on water. Oh, no. And there was Andrea Mitchell, his wife on MSNBC, sitting there as part of the government media complex, supporting him at every turn. I've warned you about the government media complex. I believe there has to be – heads have to roll. And I believe you have to look where it starts at the top, not the tail of the snake, but the head of the snake. And that's the Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan who let this happen, and Bernanke who's letting it happen again. There's no reason in the world that the Treasury Secretary should be able to take taxpayer money and bail out his friends on Wall Street. No siree, Bob. That's one of the topics we're going to talk about today, the poor, the rich, and the clueless. Bush, the socialist leader of the very rich, and Obama, the socialist leader of the very poor. We're going to talk about the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac swindle. We are going to talk about how the war has fundamentally bankrupted America. We're going to talk about other factors related to this economic crisis on the Savage Nation and other topics as well, including the shameful speeches by McCain and Obama before the racist group La Raza. The reason I call it a racist group is because they proudly call themselves the race. Now, if there was a group called the National Association for the Advancement of White People, or a group called the race, and it represented only white people and advancing the interests of white people, what would you call that? Would you call it a fair-minded, integrative organization, or would you call it a racist organization? If a white group called the race appeared, And a presidential candidate went before that group and said, you know, you white people are the best. We're going to work together once I become president. And we're going to help you and your people only. Because your rich tapestry of European ancestry that make up the white community are part of a greater community. And we all have a stake in each other. And I am going to help you once I win this election. And together after we win this election, you white people, we will transform this nation. Tell me what would happen today. You know what would happen today. But you sit there like schmucks, you white people, while presidential candidates appeal to a group called La Raza, the race. I'm not going to sit here and say I agree with that. I find the group called the race a supremacist group, a separatist group. Why should we sit here and say thank you to Obama and McCain for pandering to them? I don't think we should. And that goes for all people, including Hispanic people, who should not be supporting a group that supports only one race in a nation that's supposed to be a Statue of Liberty for all, not a Statue of Liberty for one race. Those are some of the topics that are on my mind. There are other topics that are also floating around in the world, the universe, the layoffs in the newspaper business. Chicago Tribune editor resigns. LA Times publisher David Hiller resigns. Hitler is coming to New York City again. What a wonderful opportunity. God, Hitler's coming to New York City again. What a wonderful opportunity to stop World War III. He could be arrested and he could not be permitted to leave. But you know that the boys on Wall Street would never permit that. They're probably deeply invested in Iranian-related assets in some way, probably through the UAE or some other third country. And so they would never arrest the Hitler of Iran. What matters is the bottom line. But, you know, these are the serious topics, and they're very important, and I would like to talk about them. And I don't need to talk about Schumer. I know about his relationship to the collapse of the Indy Bank. I know he put out the letter, and, of course, Schumer should be investigated as to why he sent that letter to the Indy Bank, who he spoke with before he sent the letter to the Indy Bank, and what banks wanted the Indy Bank to collapse. Are they the same is it the same situation as those on Wall Street who wanted to feed off the carcass of Bear Stearns? I would think so. I know how things work. And when you have an unregulated system, when you have a system without regulation, what you have are gangs without tattoos. What you have are gangs in white shirts. What you have are gangs in Savile Row suits. What you have are gangs without shaved heads, who are far more dangerous than those with shaved heads, tattoos, and AK-47s. That's what you have functioning right now, gangs who do not represent a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but a government of the very, very rich, by the very, very rich, and for the very, very rich. Now, let me tell you something. I am not a poor man. I was a poor man. I was born to an immigrant, and I had a struggle for everything I have. Every step of the way was like walking on glass, walking through fire. Impediments were put in my way, and they still are. So everything I have worked for and I've earned. I am not a poor man, but I know what it is to be a poor man in this land. I also learned one thing when I was poor, that nothing stopped me from becoming wealthy if I had the guts and the brains and the willingness to try for it. But I never expected the government to bail me out. And yet we have George Bush bailing out his friends on Wall Street through Bernanke, the Fed chairman, who's going to bail out the banks and bail out the investment houses. But they're not going to bail you out. Why are they bailing them out? And what will that do to our currency? What will that do to our currency? In the second segment of today's show, I have a very, very special treat for you. I received some very special microphones last week, which are now plugged into my Mackie board. My normal workhorse microphone is what's on now. It's the one I use every day and have for year after year. It's the standard of the business. It's the workhorse. It's an RE20. Everybody knows the microphone. It is the Budweiser beer horse of talk radio. It pulls the wagon. It doesn't go very fast, but it goes very, very far. But in my hand, actually connected to the Mackie board, are some Rolls-Royce microphones. And I'm not going to give you the names of them yet. One lists at $5,298. The other one lists at $1,575, while the old workhorse that I have that I'm using is, well, under $500, and it does a great job. What I'm going to do for you in the next segment is let you go behind the scenes in the radio business, talk radio, which everybody dreams of becoming a talk radio star. Now, never mind they tell you otherwise. They'd all love a microphone, particularly those in the newspaper business who will soon be sitting in cafes drinking espresso Well, if they can afford an espresso, I don't know if that's possible on the amount that they're going to take out of the newspaper retirement fund. But whatever they're going to be drinking in the cafes or at home grousing, it's not fun when you lose your job. I am going to use these microphones, and I'm going to have you listen and tell me if you hear any difference. And then we'll talk about Greenspan, the Federal Reserve System, the banking debacle, people lining up for cash, crying online. We're going to talk about Obama's shameful speech to La Raza. We're going to play McCain's shameful speech to La Raza. But right now, what I'd like you to do is listen to Obama's shameful pandering to the race in clip 24.
This country belongs to every one last of us. Every one of us.
Hold it, hold it. Every one last of us. Well, that's true. If we let him get elected, it will be every one last of us. But go on.
Gay, straight, young, old, Native American, new immigrant, this November, we're coming together to turn the page on the failed policies of the past, to bring new energy and new ideas to the challenges that we face. And together, we are not just going to win this election. We will transform this nation. Thank you, and God bless you. I appreciate you all. Thank you very much.
So he's a transformational candidate. Well, on the face of it, that's good. But do you want to gamble on a transformation of America with an untested, unknown, unproven man? Now, I have my problems with McCain. You know them. I've been a big critic of the McCain-Kennedy bill. I've been a big critic of his flip-flopping on so many issues. The fact that he's a rhino is a problem, a Republican name only. We know this. But McCain is a certifiable war hero. McCain is a true American. I never question McCain's loyalty. I do question Obama's loyalty. I do question his wife's loyalties. And I'm not so sure that I want to risk my future on a transformational character like Obama. I'll be right back. Savage. Let's hear clip 17. We'll hear Obama. Let's hear it.
For centuries, those values of hard work and patriotism and faith and family, the values that have made the Hispanic community so strong, have made America strong too. That's what's at stake this November. This election is nothing less than a test of our allegiance to the American dream. And it's a test of our commitment to all those who are counting on us to keep that dream alive. The people you serve every single day, they're counting on us to stop the hateful rhetoric filling our airwaves, rhetoric that poisons our political discourse and degrades our democracy and has no place in this great nation.
Oh, you know what? Screw you, Obama. You're the hateful one. You're the devil, not me. Patriotism is suddenly hateful, Obama? Minding the law is hateful, Obama? Encouraging Hispanic illegals to break the law is suddenly patriotic, Obama? You're never going to get my vote, Obama, and anyone who votes for you should have their head examined. Hateful rhetoric that poisons our airwaves when we say don't run over our border, don't crush our laws, don't abuse our hospitals, don't abuse our schools, don't abuse our courts. That's hateful rhetoric, Obama? No, Obama, you're the hateful rhetorician, not those of us on talk radio. And it's time people stood up to you, Obama. And stop fearing the race card being thrown by the demagogues out there. No, Obama, you're the hateful one. No, Obama, you are the hateful one. And you are a dangerous man, Obama, for encouraging 30 million illegal aliens to demand citizenship after they broke our immigration laws. No, Obama, you are the dangerous one saying that anyone who dares speak about this is suddenly hateful. That's the kind of rhetoric you'd expect from Nazi Germany. That's the kind of rhetoric you would have expected in Mussolini's Italy. That's the kind of rhetoric you would have expected in Stalin's Russia. I don't expect that in the United States of America, Obama, but I certainly would expect it from you, looking at your background and your friendships and what you'd like to do to this nation. How's that for a speech, Obama? Because you just heard it from Michael Savage. Now, what I'm going to do is switch microphones. I'm on my RE20. Listen to this fun we're going to have now. I'm going to move over to something else. Play the drum roll. Here we go. And I am back. Michael Savage is back on the Rolls Royce of microphones. Is anyone out there listening to this show who can hear the difference? Is there a difference in your radio? Now, here's the interesting thing about radio. I'm doing this to entertain you, of course, but it's also intriguing to me. It'd be like a pilot who gets a new plane to play with. I have a wonderful airplane called an RE-20. Now I'm flying a Rolls Royce of microphones. But people say it's a waste of money because they say AM speakers just don't pick up all the tonality that these microphones, these condenser microphones, are capable of. Is anyone out there listening to me on hi-fi speakers, a hi-fi system, if you still call it that? I don't even know. I'm stuck in a way technologically when I still call it hi-fi. But most people don't listen to AM radio on, you know, anything other than a car speaker or a house speaker. But some of you, I know, have your radios tuned to tremendous systems because you love my voice. And now I'm using a different microphone. And if you'd like to comment, please do so right now at 1-800-449-8255, because I'm not going to do this for very long. But I am going to shift in a few seconds to yet another microphone. Now, try to remember, this is one. I'm going to shift. Play the drum roll again. Now back on the trapeze is Michael Savage with microphone number three. You just heard microphone number two. This is microphone number three. It is another very famous studio microphone that studio recording musicians use for the warm, rich sound that is tailored to deliver specifics of a person's voice. It has a switchable pattern, cardioid, omnidirectional, and bidirectional patterns for those of you in the business. Bring down the mic a bit. Mike will bring down the mic a bit. I just brought the mic down a bit. How's that, folks? Is that better? Okay, so that's microphone number three. And I'll talk about printing money, Greenspan, war versus banks, pulling money out of banks. Did Schumer bust the bank? Socialists should be happy with Bush's bank bailout. McCain, I've earned the Hispanics' trust. All the stories I'm going to talk about are on michaelsavage.com, including the fact that Eskimos are killing whales with glee, and the government will not stop them. That's my headline, which is Native American Aleuts are killing whales with glee, and nobody will stop them. What if you killed a whale? How about a bat?
Savage.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to the Savage Nation. We have three different high wires for you to listen to and watch. We have three different microphones plugged in. I'm using all three, of course, independently. Right now, I'm on one of them. I'm not going to tell you which one. Then we're going to go to the others. But I asked you which mic sounded better, one, two, or three. And this is because, let's be honest with you, those of you who listen to the show regularly, listen to other shows. I'm gifted with a number of things, and one of the greatest gifts I've ever been granted by God is my voice. It is my instrument. It's my horn. But, you know, the transmission of that horn depends upon, to a certain extent, so many complicated factors, but the number one factor is the microphone. But everyone in the business says you don't need a better microphone than the RE-20 because, you know, the others may cost $5,000, but they're not going to deliver what the listener is going to hear. They're not going to hear it. Most of it will be lost in transmission. It is not FM radio. So I'm asking you, did you hear a difference? And we'll start with Matt in Salt Lake City. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Matt, which mic did you like best?
I like the first and third. The second one, yeah, kind of sound like you're on a commercial, kind of a pretty boy voice.
A pretty boy voice?
Yeah. Interesting.
So it mellows out the voice and makes it sound like a regular kind of radio show. That's interesting. What microphone do you think I'm on now, Matt?
I don't know. I have my radio turned off.
Okay, that's helpful. Thanks for a... Chip in Albany, New York. Chip, which microphone did you like best?
You know, the first time around, I liked the middle one, and I'll tell you why. Any good microphone is measured by how accurately it feeds out what you're feeding into it. I feel like that RE-20 maybe overly inflated your bottom end a little bit, and the second microphone, I think, was a more accurate representation of your true voice.
Wow. What about mic number three? I don't know which is three. Which one was number two, guys? Is that the Sure? The Neumann's number two? Are you sure? Yeah. Okay, well, here's what we're going to do. Chip and everyone else listening to Savage Nation, right now I'm on mic one, which is the RE20, the workhorse. Are you in the business, Chip?
Well, I work at the nation's largest musical instrument retailer, so I do have experience with these products, yes.
Okay, so this microphone, the RE20, which you're used to, sounds like me.
Correct.
Okay, now hold on now. I'm going to shift over to a different one. Stay tuned. Roll the drums. And I'm back on the Savage Nation. Chip, I'm on another microphone. Which one am I on?
It sounds to me like you're probably on the third microphone now.
Oh, I think you're good.
Yeah,
I think you're good. Now, how does my voice sound to you now? Does this sound like me?
No, you know, not to what I'm used to, because, you know, knowing now that you use the RE20 regularly, I know that I'm used to hearing your voice through an RE20. But the one that you're through right now, it seems like it's muddling up some of the frequencies a little bit, and they're blending together a little too much. Again.
Blend, and that's very interesting. I'm going to disclose to the audience in a few moments which microphones we're using and whether or not I want to use them, or I may stick to the workhorse, the Budweiser beer horse, so to speak. I thank you very much for your industrious input. Ian in Washington, D.C., welcome to the Savage Nation. Which microphone did you like best?
I think I like three. I'm actually going to guess what microphone three is, matter of fact. I think
Hold on, guys. What microphone number am I on now? One, two? I'm on two or three? I'm on number two now. Okay, Ian, I'm on number two now. Why did you like three?
It sounds a little bit more present, and I thought two sounded a little bit thin. The RE20.
I'm on number two right now, which is the most expensive. You don't like the sound as much?
It sounds a little thin. I'm thinking that the AKG 414, which I'm guessing is number three, sounded a little bit better.
Well, I'm not going to disclose it yet. We'll have two more calls before we go into the politics again. Right now we're going into the microphones. I'm doing a little something for your entertainment value, for the entertainment value of the show, because after all, radio is also about keeping the audience, let us say, engaged. I mean, anyone can sound off, and I do enough of that. But I've been on the air for 15 years, and I'm just trying something new. I guess I want to see if I want to fly a different kind of airplane. Let us go to Tony in New York. Tony, your opinion on the microphones, please.
Michael, I think the first one, the RE20, is the best. It seemed to present your voice just like you were sitting in a room across from me, even though I'm in my car. The other ones presented some sort of a barrier in between your voice.
Interesting. All right, Tony, are you in your car right now?
Yes, I am, but the radio's off because that's what I was told to do.
Oh, right. You have to turn it off to hear me. That's right. Well, turn the radio on anyway for a minute. Turn the car radio back on. I want to hear. We've got a time delay. So.
I'm just trying.
Tony, how do I sound on the car radio now?
Airplane. Let us go to Tony in New York.
It's not bad. It's not bad. It sounds more like the first one. The third one was a little shaky because the first time you put it on, it sounded like there was some sort of interference, but then it sort of smoothed out.
Well, we'll keep trying. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to take one or two more calls here on the microphone thing. And look, the fact of the matter is I'll disclose right now what I'm playing with here. The first microphone, number one, which I guess I have to shift back to. So give it a drum roll again. And we're back on the Savage Nation with microphone number one, which is the beer horse of talk radio. It is the RE20. Everybody uses it. It is the Electro Voice RE20 with shock mount and a rubber filter. It's a gigantic, ugly filter in your face that you can put in microwave ovens to sterilize if you're in a radio studio and you don't want to get, let's say, a flu germ. So I use the standard RE20 with a mic muff for years. I'll show you. If I pull the mic muff off, listen. Hi, this is the same microphone without the mic muff. What happens is I pop my peas, and you can't pop your peas, especially if you get angry like I do sometimes, and it breaks up. So what I have to do is put the mic muff back on, and that's the microphone I normally use. And now we're going to shift over to mic number two, drum roll. Well, I guess I'm on number two. I don't know what number this is, but I am now on a Shure microphone, a very expensive multiple pattern condenser microphone. It's a KSM-44. And it's basically used in recording studios for singers and musicians. It is often not used by talk hosts, almost never used by talk hosts, because it is too sensitive. It's fine if you're playing a guitar. It's fine if you're playing a trumpet. I don't know if it's so fine if you're just using your voice, because it's too sensitive. And I don't know if you want overly sensitive. This microphone lists for $1,575. I'm now going to shift to the next microphone. Drum roll, please. And here I am on the Rolls-Royce of studio microphones. It's the Neumann U87. The 40th anniversary edition lists for something like $5,000. I don't know if this is the 40th anniversary edition, but it's a standard of the industry, the Neumann microphone, since 1967. It's well known for its very warm tones, its well-balanced tones, and it has all sorts of advanced roll-off switches, cardioid capacities, all sorts of things that I will never use. But I like it because it comes in a wooden box, which is something to look. I could put the wooden box in the drawer. I mean, you should buy one just to have in your house. You should buy one of these and put them in your house if you would dream of becoming a talk show host. But here we are on the Neumann U87. What do you think of this one, ladies and gentlemen? I'll take one or two more calls. I've done this for entertainment value. Does anybody like this microphone the best? Because if you do, I'm just going to be out $5,000 and I'm going to buy it. If you don't, I'll go back to the workhorse. Dale, Las Vegas, Nevada, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, keep your number one. It sounds good, and so did number three. The number two just isn't worth it. And to tell you the truth, you sound good on all three. And if you talked over a tin can phone, I'd still listen to you. It's what you say.
Hey, how does my laugh sound on this Neumann?
I don't know. It took me years to get over your New York accent, but now that I'm comfortable with that, I'm from the Deep South. No matter what you say, it sounds fantastic.
You know what I love about this call? This is so true, and I've tried to tell people that. Everyone with a regional accent, whether it be a southern accent or a New York accent, there are a few other very strong regionals, you know that, has an inherent bias going into the conversation if they meet someone, let's say, in an airport. Immediately someone's going to pick it up and say, are you from New York? I've had that all my life. Yeah, I'm from New York. I say, how did you guess, Sherlock? You know, and usually they either get mad at me or they smile. And right away I know whether to continue talking with them. But once you overcome that initial prejudice that we all have for a strange accent, which we all have, by the way, prejudice means prejudging, bias, you know what I'm saying? And there's nothing wrong with a bias. We all have them. Once you get over that initial bias of the accent and listen to what the man is actually saying, if you have an open mind, which liberals generally don't and conservatives sometimes do, it doesn't matter what the accent is. And that's why, Dale, I've come to appreciate the Southeastern, the Southern accent guys. The guys who call my show from the South are generally my most loyal listeners. In some strange way, I resonate with them. I don't know why. I'm not from the South. But at a certain point, our values are almost identical.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that, Michael. I've listened to you no matter what jobs I've worked, no matter where I've been. I can hear you in another car in traffic sometimes at a stoplight.
I love Las Vegas. I appreciate it. It's a very, very interesting city, and I thank you for calling. So we're back to the question. Should we talk about Greenspan and his wife, the government media complex? We will in a minute. War versus currencies? We will. We're going to talk about all of that. Printing the money for the bailout, George Bush, the socialist president of the very rich, or Obama, the socialist president of the illegal alien and the very poor. I mean, which one do you choose here? If I have to choose between the two, I'll go with the very rich over the very poor, because I know where the very poor have led countries before. I'll be right back.
Savage.
We are going to walk into a new future for this country that we all love. That's how we'll make the system work for everyone. For everyone, by living up to the ideals of NCLR, living up to the ideals of this organization, the ideals reflected in your name, La Raza, the people.
You're not very good at Spanish, Obama. Look it up in a Spanish-English dictionary. La Raza does not mean the people, it means the race, which I've pointed out for at least 10 years on the radio. But go on, let's listen to this man pander, let's listen to more.
This country, belongs to every one last of us. Every one of us.
No, no, no. Let's stop right here. You jumped ahead. All right. I'll go to the callers now. Paul in Los Angeles, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Michael, there's no question about it. Number one is the mic for your voice. It conveys a sense of deity and a personal boldness. It demands listening. It totally.
Hold on. I'm back on my workhorse now, number one. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Number one, the RE20, the electric voice I think it's made by. That's
yes.
The mic for you. Number two sounded weak, distorted, thin, far away, out of phase. And number three was characterless. It was too safe. It was too soft focused. There was no boldness to it. You belong on number one. The only other cheapo mic that you could maybe sound amazing on, similar to the RE20, would be a Shure SM7, which is another $400 dynamic microphone. Forget two and three. Number one is your mic.
I'm in the booklet right now. I'm looking at the broadcast industry books. You know, I look at them now like I used to look at car magazines. I don't see the Shure SM7. I've always liked the Neumann packaging, to be honest with you. Oh, here's the Shure SM7. It's $349. But you're a record producer, Paul?
Yeah, I make records. I mix records. I'm a sound engineer.
Do you do voice records, or it's mainly instrumental stuff?
No, it's pop music. It's everything and every style of music out there. And I tend to lean toward the less expensive mics that make you sound like you.
Interesting. So, in other words, if you were a wine guy, you'd go for $2 Chuck rather than the $2,000 bottle.
Only if I could find a $2 Chuck that tasted like a $30 bottle.
That's funny. That's funny. I was in my friend's restaurant over the weekend, and I said, "Remember, you once had your wine expert on my show when I was a local host." And here's da-da-da-da from Soho restaurant. I said to him, "What's the difference between a $20 bottle and a $40 bottle?" The guy says $20. The owner almost killed him when he got back to the restaurant. But anyway, the RE20, so that is the workhorse. I should stick to it. Yeah, I put the others on the back already, on the back bench for guests in case I get the mayor or the governor or the president in my studio. They're waiting for them.
Exactly. The Shure KSM-44, put that on eBay. And then keep the 87 wooden box as a memento and store the RE20 in that wooden box.
No, I would never keep anything that I didn't buy. I may keep all three of them and just keep them in my collection of microphones. But, Paul, thank you very much for joining in the revelry here on the Savage Nation. Look, these are very, very troublesome times. You know, it is a perplexing time for me and for everyone else. You know, I've worked hard. I've gotten a certain amount of money put away. You think I know what to do with it? Do you think I haven't consulted with people far wealthier than myself who tell me also they don't know what to do with it? They're hiding in T-bills, making, 1.5-2% a year? They won't even put it in a bank? You know, the people I know with big money, and believe me, I say big money, I mean big money. I'm not talking about $200,000. I'm not talking about $2 million. I'm not talking about $20 million. I'm talking about very big figures. They don't know what to do with their money. So don't think that if you're a regular guy who has under $1 million that you're alone and not knowing what to do. Nobody knows what to do. It's unique to our time to be in a place like this where banks are not producing any interest and financial markets are roiled with swindlers and filled with pirates who will rob every dime you have. And not to know what to do with your money. So we're all in the same place here. I don't have any advice to give you. And if I did, I wouldn't give it to you anyway because it could be wrong and you'd wind up, you know, really hating me. And I would never do that to somebody. I'm not here to give you financial advice. Go to a show that specializes in that and then get back to me in a year and tell me whether it was right or wrong. I know certain things are in play right now, and I know that most of it has to do with larceny. I know that most of what is being done right now is based upon larcenous individuals who are in very high places. I also know that if we had a legitimate investigative arm of the SEC, there would be people in prison. Well, there would be people indicted right now who have not been indicted. They got the small fry. They left the big guys on top alone. I would say this goes all the way up to the top, and I would say that one of the reasons we're in this trouble is because of the war. Now you say, well, are you therefore agreeing with the liberals? Well, in theory, I am not. Rather, in principle, I am not. nor in theory am I agreeing with the liberals, but from a practical point of view, I would say that it may be time, as I've actually said over the years, to win and get out. I have said use the heavy hammer and get out of there. And the only reason I could see us still being there, to the extent that we're there, primarily in Iraq, is because the contracting billions are so big without any oversight that we're never going to get out of there, not soon. And believe me, many of you leftists or liberals think that Obama's different and he's going to pull you out. You're wrong. He's giving you the same malarkey that Pelosi gave you. Don't you remember as near as the last election cycle when Pelosi and Reid were making a lot of noise about the war, and Bush? They've been very silent for 9 months now, haven't they? They're actually as quiet as mice. And that is because the Republican gang was forced to share in the spoils of war, and that is the Reconstruction projects, in my estimation. Now, if you think that the banking debacle that we're witnessing today is a result of deregulation and no oversight, you're right. That's exactly why we're having it. But if you think there was deregulation in the banking industry, it is nothing compared to the lack of oversight in the contracting industry with regard to Iraq. Billions of dollars go missing. Well, let's say hundreds of millions go unaccounted for, that we know. Hundreds of millions sent over in airplanes have disappeared. Nobody knows where it went. Billions of dollars have been granted in no-bid contracts to friends and cronies of those in high places. They're building Olympic-sized swimming pools for ungrateful Iraqis. Well, Yuma, you don't have a swimming pool in community, do you? My roads are broken here in San Francisco. There's potholes all over the city. And yet the roads are brand new in Iraq. You see, first you break it, then you rebuild it, and there's a lot of money in both. And those who make the munitions for breaking it probably also provide the contracts for mending it. It's like the old guy who, I think it was Trun's Meat, or one of the meat packers said, I sell everything but the squeal. They kill the pig and sell the hide. They sell the gristle. They sell the bone. They sell the snout and they sell the butt. And they sell everything but the squeal. Same way with the war. You make it going in and you make it going out.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Doors, their bank seized.
Good news and bad news.
Jittery customers of the former IndyMac lining up, wanting to know what's happened to my money.
So what about the people that have over 100K? Would they be able to withdraw their money?
The FDIC's response, if you have less than $100,000 in a single account, it is fully insured. You can get your hands on all of it Monday. But for bigger depositors, it's complicated.
I have several accounts there, and a few of them are over six figures.
Keith Graves says he's one of the about 10,000 customers who had more money in his accounts than the FDIC insured.
No, go to Blue Monday. Believe me, it's a Blue Monday. It's not Black Friday. It's Blue Monday on the Savage Nation.
Blue Monday. How are you, Blue Monday? Got to work like a slave all day.
It is the Savage Nation, and the reason I'm a dog lover is quite simple, and I've been a dog lover all my life, is because, A, I don't know Charles Schumer, and I don't know that any dog would love Charles Schumer, and B, a dog is like a perennial bum in the house, which is why we love them. Even conservatives occasionally like a hippie bum in the house, and a dog is sort of having a hippie bum around the house, and it reminds you of what life is all about. We're sitting here looking at the Treasury Secretary bailing out his friends, according to people in the business. We are seeing stories that say, did Schumer bust the bank? We look at John McCain's so-called Republicans saying, I've earned the Hispanics' trust speaking at the racist conference. We see experts saying that socialists should be happy with Bush's bank bailout. We are looking at Aleutian Indians, that is Eskimos, killing whales, even though it's been outlawed for quite a number of decades now, with the government looking the other way, while if you keep a library book for an extra 30 days, the tax squad will probably break your door in. We are looking at satire in the New Yorker magazine where Obama is seen with a turban and his wife has a big afro with an AK-47 making her look like Angela Davis. And the magazine, of course, is saying the cover is meant to satirize the use of scare tactics and misinformation in the presidential election. The fact of the matter is I don't think that these are scare tactics. Obama's middle name is a Muslim name. Obama's mentors and friends are radicals and dangerous radicals. His wife's rhetoric is that of, frankly, Angela Davis Light. So I don't know where – what, liberals are suddenly overly sensitive to satire? They don't like satirical covers? Do we have our first equivalent in America of the Muhammad as time bomb cover? Sure, because the liberals and al-Qaeda share an awful lot in common. They cannot take criticism of any kind. They're oh so sensitive when it comes to their, shall we say, whose ox – is being gored. When our ox is being gored with illegal aliens and they're overrunning the country like locusts, and we say enough is enough and we don't want the illegals overrunning the country, they say that it's fine and we're racists and we've gone too far. But when a satirist who happens to be doing it for a liberal magazine called The New Yorker satirizes Obama with a turban and Mrs. Obama with an Angela Davis do and an AK, they say that they don't want freedom of speech, freedom of the press. And that's what you're going to get from liberals, which is totalitarianism. It's where Nancy Pelosi falls on the issue, where she says she wants talk radio stopped because it's too critical of her and her business dealings. I mean, let's be clear. Why do you think they don't want any criticism? Because a freedom of the press is very dangerous for despots, whether they be al-Qaeda or the Democrats. And so, my friends, be very careful whose speech you ban today, because tomorrow it could be yours. So when you look at all of these events and the collapse of a bank and what's coming next with the troublesome times that we're living in, and you say, God, the banks are closing, or at least one did, what's tomorrow? They say another 150 banks could go. The Treasury Secretary is alleged to be bailing out his friends, according to an insider. They're calling the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac an unmitigated disaster. I mean, frankly, it is an unmitigated disaster. Remember what went on during the Chrysler bailout some odd years ago when it was so controversial to bail out Chrysler? Where did this come in all of a sudden that Bush gets to write checks to bail anyone out that he wants? What kind of imperial presidency do we have here? Well, apparently he even has to go to Congress on this. I was shocked to find that out. I thought he could just do it down at Crawford in between chopping wood and hosting people to mint tea from the Middle East. But no, apparently still has to go to an antiquated institution called Congress. But as far as I'm concerned, it's only a matter of time till they're bailed out. But we should be looking at Mr. Paulson. Mr. Paulson is part of the problem, not part of the solution. And that's because Mr. Paulson, as I pointed out on the show, comes from a wonderful investment bank named Goldman Sachs. Now, I have nothing against investment banks, nor particularly do I have anything against Goldman Sachs. They're a fine institution. I am concerned, though, when an institution such as an investment bank has provided three Treasury secretaries, none of whom I had any faith in, not one. And they're all interlocked and all tied together, going back to the fisherman, the fly fisherman, who was Bill Clinton's Treasury secretary. So that is why I say I love dogs, because they're like having a hippie bum under your desk. Think about it. They wear the same clothing day in and day out. They don't bathe unless you force them to bathe. They're very, very indifferent as to what they eat. They don't take vitamins. They don't worry about dying. They don't think about God. They don't think about the next world. They give you absolutely undivided love and attention. All you got to do is be nice to them and feed them. All they want to do is be your friend. And that's why we all love dogs, because they're much like having a hippie bum around the house. And so that's why Teddy is sitting here underneath the desk, and he's listening to it. I mean, my dog. Yeah, he's asleep. He's giving this show a four-paw review, which is meaning he's on his back snoring, and all four paws are in the air. Now, if I get excited and start to scream and yell, it might become a two-paw review, because he'll roll over on his side and only 2 feet will be free to the air. And if it really gets bad, he might actually stand up and look at me or walk around, and then it's a zero-paw review. So I'm going to stick to the four-paw variety of the Savage Nation, where he sleeps comfortably on his back. You know, and I'll tell you why. There's another reason for it. I'm pulling your leg a little bit, although my view of dogs is something I came up over the weekend with. I'm starting to sound like Obama, mixing up syntax and words. No, it's the bum-like effect, value of a pet that we love. Many of us wish we could be more like them instead of more like a Wall Street banker. So uptight that they wind up braying on all fours in a dominatrix's pad on the weekends from what they've done all week to everybody, everybody else. I never met anybody who went to a dominatrix, by the way. All you need is a regular mother for that one in the age that I grew up. What do you need a dominatrix for? Eat this, eat that, don't eat this, don't eat that. You'll get a cold, you'll fall off the balcony. What do you need a dominatrix for? If you grew up in the house I grew up in, what did you need a dominatrix for? I don't understand why people pay for that. All you got to do is live through what I lived through. Who needed a dominatrix? The screaming and the yelling, the key in the mailbox. I mean, for God's sakes, a diet that could have killed a lab animal. So the reason I'm not going to scream and yell very much today is because I've come to an epiphany of sorts on the Savage Nation. You know what the epiphany is? My audience is so loyal to this show that, for example, in the last hour, if you just joined us, I did a microphone check trial with three new microphones, two new ones and one old one. And I did that. And I said, who's going to do this in a time like this? Who would risk losing an audience? I said, I won't lose my audience. My audience is dedicated to me. I'm part of their family. They're part of my family. I have latitude to experiment on this show. It's the product of many years of building an audience. They call it a franchise. Now, you can't get overly, arrogant about it. I can't come out here and suddenly say I'm for Obama, because I'm not. I couldn't come out here and say, I love illegal aliens, let's legalize them, because I wouldn't do that. I don't believe in it. I mean, certain, things you can't do because you shouldn't do. It would make you into a fraud and a liar. But other than that large parameter of not screwing your audience around with lies, a mature show has a loyal audience. And so I don't have to scream and yell to make my points. You understand what I'm saying to you? I mean, when I get angry, I'll get angry, but I'm trying not to get angry because I'm in it for the long haul. Now, I see things coming in the next few months and years that even I fear as a talk show host. I do not think these are going to be stable times. I know they're going to be very unstable times. How bad it will get is anybody's guess. Did it get worse than I thought, faster than it would happen? Yes. Is this the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end of the debacle? My friends, it is not the beginning of the end. It's the end of the beginning of the debacle. We're just at the infant stage of what's coming. I told you 6 months ago on this show, The Savage Nation, that George Bush, in his 6 years and 6.5 years or 6.25 years of damage, did nothing compared to what he would do in the last 6 months of his tenure. And I am telling you that I was prescient in what I said to you. You haven't seen much of what's going to happen. You're just seeing the tip of the iceberg now with, how many months are left of this presidency? 6 months are left. How many months to the vote? July, August, September, October, August, 3 months, 3.5 months till we elect a new president. We have 6 months of this presidency. We don't know what he's going to do next. We do know that he is a man almost... He's lurching. He lurches from left to left and to left again. We know that George Bush is a socialist, but he's not a socialist in the tradition that we have come to understand socialists and socialism, is he? George Bush is a socialist of the very rich. He bails out his very, very wealthy friends. And I mean the folks who don't even buy Gulfstreams. I mean the folks who give Gulfstreams to their children for presents. I'm talking about the folks who buy Boeing 737s and Boeing models and convert them from 80-seaters to 8-seaters and give the Gulfstreams to their hired help. I'll be right back. Savage.
centuries, those values of hard work and patriotism and faith and family, the values that have made the Hispanic community so strong, have made America strong too. That's what's at stake this November. This election is nothing less than a test of our allegiance to the American dream. And it's a test of our commitment to all those who are counting on us to keep that dream alive. The people you serve every single day, they're counting on us to stop the hateful rhetoric filling our airwaves, rhetoric that poisons our political discourse. Right.
Well, you are poisoning the airwaves with your rhetoric supporting illegal aliens who have broken the law, Obama. You're the one who's doing it. You're poisoning the rhetoric. You're poisoning the airwaves. You're poisoning the political machine with your lies. How dare you pander to illegal aliens and call those of us who are patriots the evildoers? That's so bad. Now, you, the listener, you, the voter, have a big job ahead of you. And certainly you're not going to be swayed by me. I'm pretty sure most of you made your mind up. But your biggest problem may not be with the politicians. It may be with the media. Now, there are targets in the media who are obvious. We know who they are. Many of them have been thrown out. Dan Rather no longer has a job. Narrow Shoulders is long gone from ABC. Many of them have come and gone because they've been exposed. You know, all of us like to believe we're the best, but we couldn't do this. That's true for me and everybody else. Everybody in talk radio thinks they're the best. It's a nature of the business. And if you don't have pride, you can't fight. And it's the same with pride fighters. You get them in the ring. If they don't think they're the best, they'll get their face ripped open. They'll be thrown out of the ring. They'll be beaten to a pulp. You better go in there with the biggest heart you have. You shouldn't step over those ropes. Now, I'm setting it up for something I'm about to tell you. One of the biggest disappointments to me is Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh has been a front for the Republican Party and George Bush for as long as I can remember. And today he had the audacity. He has lifted things from me for years without giving me credit. I understand that. And I don't mind. Mozart understood that Salieri had to steal ideas from him. And Mozart knew he was Mozart and Salieri was Salieri. It didn't matter that Salieri was more popular, made more money. What mattered was is that even Salieri knew who Mozart was. But today was a new low. It's been sent to me that Rush Limbaugh stole the concept of Paul Revere from the man who created the Paul Revere Society. And many of you still hold proudly your collector's item, the Paul Revere Society membership cards. I stopped that society a number of years ago. It was impossible and untenable to continue because the government made it almost impossible for me to continue it. And I never went into details on why I stopped it, but I'm giving you a hint right now. Today, Rush Limbaugh said, "I'm happy to be your Paul Revere. You don't need any other person." I would rather see him say, "I'm happy to be your Paul Insincere," because I believe that any man who supports George Bush and republicanism to the extent that he has and still does is not Paul Revere, but Paul Insincere. And I'll rest my case right at that. I don't need to make him my enemy because he isn't my enemy. My enemy is Osama bin Laden. My enemy are the people setting off roadside bombs in Afghanistan who killed our troops, 9 boys, over the weekend. Those are the real enemies of America. And the rest is just, you know, whatever, disagreements. But to call yourself Paul Revere when you're really Paul Insincere, and when you ride flyover country and basically you drop your waste products on the simple people and then tell them you're on their side, I'm sorry, it doesn't work for me. And speaking of flyover country, there was an interesting article in the Old York Times over the weekend, and I canceled the subscription finally and reluctantly. The newspaper's not going to be swapping in my driveway every morning. I don't know if I'm going to be able to live without the sound of a newspaper hitting my driveway. I've had it for so many years. I'm addicted. I'm an older guy. To me, the sound of the newspaper thwapping in the driveway was a mark of suburban comfort. It's like not southern comfort, but suburban comfort food. Some nights I can't sleep that well, or I sleep lightly and I toss and turn and I look forward to the illegal alien's car and the sound of the newspaper, the high-carbon newspaper with a high-carbon footprint in a high-carbon car from a high-carbon immigrant. You know, it made my night. So very soon I'll have to find out whether I have to resubscribe or not. But they did an interesting article about the new hitchhikers who want to charm their way onto your private jet. Hey, big spender flying my way, which was quite fascinating about the bums who hitch rides with the fake rich. And the fake rich, of course, the ones who prop themselves up for articles like this are not the real McCoy. They would never appear in an article like this. Instead, you have nouveau riche showing themselves with their rented Learjet. But one of them advised to bring food if you get on a private jet, where chicken wings would
Savage.
Work.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation, 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I'm back to the workhorse on the Savage Nation. I am the true Paul Revere of talk radio, not the Paul Insincere's who have had the nerve to even steal that. I mean, are they that desperate? For God's sakes. They have no originalities. Anyway, says a great article. Hey, big spender flying my way. The new hitchhikers want to charm their way onto your private jet. And it's an article about people hitching rides with friends who have, private jets or who lease them. And the writing is kind of interesting. It says, with a pastel cashmere Loro piano cardigan, whatever that is, knotted casually around his or her neck. I have no idea what the social climbers are wearing. I am myself now wearing an old sweatshirt with a hood on it, which I wear even when I'm driving my Ferrari, which is seldom. Why would I need a pastel cashmere Loro piano cardigan unless I'm trying to be a male dancer and I'm trying out for the role? The new hitchhiker can be found in the lounges at places like Teterboro Airport in New Jersey or Aspen, Pitkin County Airport in Colorado. Well, he really ought to become a little less provincial, this guy Trebe, and add something like a Kaiser Air in Oakland, California, where there also are a few private jets. I realize it's west of the Hudson River, but a few folks on the West Coast do happen to fly in private jets, and they're not in Teterboro. Tossing off the tail numbers that are the passwords for entry to airports serving private jet traffic, a person may be heard debating the merits of a Hawker versus a Challenger, extolling the seating capacity of Gulfstream jets and rating the onboard catering at a given airport or fixed base of operation. These people do not refer to themselves as hitchhikers, of course, any more than a gold digger admits to being on the make. Well, that's a good line. What would you call somebody instead of a gold digger? A jet digger? The old aphorism that one does not marry for money but rather mingles with the rich and marries for love has useful applications when it comes to caging rides on private jets. You see, this is an interesting article because it does expose the foibles of the rich and the nouveaus and the poseurs, rather. It says, I don't think it's a calculated thing people do, said Marjorie Gubelman Rain, the socialite and cash register heiress, who admits to having hopped the odd ride. I love the odd ride. Oh, how British can you get? From New York to Palm Beach, Florida. Now, if she's an heiress, why would she have to hop the odd ride? It sounds to me like she's an heiress with an empty cash register to me. First of all, anyone who's an heiress who's quoted the New York Times already is on the skids. That's been my experience. That the very rich, you don't even hear about them. The people with real money, you never heard about. You don't even know who they are. And then they go on and blah, blah, blah. So they talk about people getting into billionaires' airplanes. You don't have to be a billionaire to be a private jet owner or a leaser, by all means. It says, still there are signs that those with their own jets won't be flying in cattle class anytime soon. The big trend is people upgrading to jumbo jets for private use, said Douglas D. Golan, the editor of Elite Traveler, the glossy journal that bills itself as the private jet lifestyle magazine. People who once cruised comfortably in a 12-seat Gulfstream G450, Mr. Golan said, now gaze covetously at a Boeing business jet, a 737 reconfigured to accommodate not 150 commercial passengers, but 18 to 25 private ones. In the land of high flyers, Mr. Golan said, the talk is of jumbo McMansions in the sky. Airbus just signed 6 orders for private A350s at a Swiss trade show, he said, referring to a $180 million jet that in its commercial application accommodates 300 passengers. Who are the buyers of these behemoths? Russian oligarchs and Chinese billionaires and Indian steel moguls and Arab royalties, he said. But there are also plenty of American entrepreneurs who made their money making widgets, billionaires who pull out of the driveway and nobody knows who they are. So then it goes into some climber couple with some beaten up old 1978 jet who posed in a bad cardigan around her neck. Looks like she could use some Jenny Craig, and he looks like he can use a little on the... a little nip and tuck, but that's irrelevant. The point is the jet's old that they're showing. I can tell you that it looks like at least 20 years old, and they're posing with it. Anyone who poses with their jet for a New York Times article. Let's say I wouldn't invest in what they're selling. Then they go into a guy who, I don't know what he does, but he hops rides on various people's jets. And he said that he brings food along. And the people who own the jets like that. And then he comes up with rules. Oh, disconnected from server. I'll love that one in a minute. I just lost my Telos connection in the middle of having fun here. But I don't think I'm going to need a caller for a minute or two, so I can play with that during the break. Here comes the best part of the private jet article that I think you'll be interested in. And, you know, it's a counterpoint to all of this doom and gloom about the collapsing banks, the collapsing economy, newspaper editors and writers being thrown out of their jobs, which is all true and all going on. But there's like several different economies at the same time. There's another economy that doesn't seem to be very much affected by all of this, and that's the economy of the private jet. But I'll tell you more about that in a minute, because it is being affected. The business is absolutely dead and flat for the charter business, and I'll tell you why in a minute, what it's going to do to the private jet business in a moment, in my opinion. So he talks about a guy who the rules of getting on there are people flying private jets. If you're, let's say, hitchhiking along with people with private jets, here's what you do. And here are the rules now. He says, referring to the typical private jet fare of cold-cut platters, fruit plates, and defrosted shrimp cocktail, Mr. S. said the gift best appreciated by jet owners is often food. He said, I stopped at a sports bar on the way to the plane once and bought 100 buffalo wings. They appreciate things like that. Well, yeah, maybe if you're a golfer with a cigar in your mouth and have no taste. If it was my private jet, which I don't have, and you brought buffalo wings, I'd ask you to leave because the stink alone would make me puke. He says they also value guests who know the rules of the road. What are the rules of the road when you're hopping around in a private jet? Never be late because they won't hold a plane for you. No kidding. Always ask the crew where you should sit. That's true, since the crew knows where the owner likes to be. Always sit in back until you're invited to move forward. That's true. Become an expert at determining how much personal space your host requires. If they want to read quietly, leave them alone. He says, but believe me, I'll perform act two of a Broadway show if it's required. See, I like this guy. In other words, he knows he has to sing for his supper. The worst thing is to have a guest who shows up at, you know, this goes back to my barbecue. Don't you understand what I'm saying to you? It's the same thing at a house when you think about it. It goes back to a house. If you're coming to a person's barbecue and he's barbecuing and sweating in the sun, and he's on fire for 3 hours and you're sitting in the living room and you won't even come out and say hello with a drink, that's not good. That's not manners. That's called being a kind of selfish narcissist, by the way. No matter what you may think of yourself, that's selfish narcissism. You don't even come out and say, how's it going? So it's the same with a jet. If you go on someone's private jet, go to the back. Don't sit in the front like you're suddenly king, you know, King Midas there, and he's there for you. You know, that's the worst kind of personality you want, whether it's in your house or your private jet. The guy who comes in and makes believe it's his house, and he's doing you a favor by being there. We all know that type of freeloader. It's really no different whether it's a hitchhiker in a car or an airplane. Given the cost of flying, blah, 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 40 million. Well, on a recent trip to Hawaii, I know someone who took a trip to Hawaii on a Gulfstream 3. It cost $70,000 to lease the jet on a lease, a one-time lease program. And the pilots had to sit in a hotel for 5 days. You know, that's all part of the tab. And the stewardess, the flight attendant, had to sit in the hotel. $70,000 round trip. Now, $40,000 of that was for fuel. Can you believe this? $40,000 went for fuel of a $70,000 charter fee. How much of the $40,000 was taxes? How much of it went to our friends, the Arabs? We don't know. Speaking of which, I'm looking into windmills now for a property I own. I own a little small country property with a fruit orchard with its own well. And I actually spent a lot of time over the weekend looking at wind power. I was amazed at what I learned. You know, I basically knew that it was a generator, a wind generator, sort of like an alternator in your car. But, you know, everyone has a generator in a car, so you know what that does. It generates electricity while the engine's running. Without it, your engine wouldn't last. Your battery would die. And, of course, you couldn't start your car again without someone else's battery or charging your battery. So these wind generators have advanced so dramatically. It could be, I don't know what, 5, 10% of our electrical use could be cut by wind power if they went back to what it was. Do you realize that there was – you ever drive through the Midwest and see all of the old windmills that are the old wind vanes? Do you realize that most farms were driven by wind energy for decades in this country, right through the Great Depression, when general electricity became rather inexpensive, the electrification of rural areas. Prior to the electrification of rural areas, if you're a farmer, you got your electricity from water power in the last two centuries ago, and probably wind power till the middle of the last century to some extent. And you know, all things come back again. Think about what we could do in this country, I was saying to myself, if we went back to wind power, to a certain extent, and advanced wind power. I mean, we are so advanced in technology that you can just imagine what we could do with windmills and, you know, wind vanes on private properties. I don't know how, you know, realistic this is for cities, although I would think that large glass towers in Manhattan, for example, or in Houston or Atlanta, large glass towers, why should they be absorbing energy in the summer that has to be converted to cool energy through air conditioning when we have the technology now to take that heat and turn it into cool energy itself? In other words, the very heat that's heating up the building could be used to cool the building if we had sane energy thinking in this country, which we don't, because we become like pigs in a trough. We've had so much cheap energy that now all of these wonderful ideas are going to come to become valid all over again, or valid for the first time. Because I know 30 years ago, during the back to earth movement of the 60s and 70s, that's what, 40 years ago? I guess time marches on, tick-tock. When Abbie Hoffman was still on the planet, when Allen Ginsberg was still caging young boys, and people still thought he was a sane American, when Timothy Leary was saying, turn on, tune in, drop out, people were talking about these things, you know, wind power and stuff. But what about water power? What about the fact that the entire Industrial Revolution was built before electricity? Think about that one. Now, what generated the power for the Industrial Revolution before electricity? We're talking about 1850, 1860. For God's sakes, look at your towns called Watertown. Why were so many factories built around rivers? Because the generation of electricity came through the water power. You know, the water, the energy of the water, turning a turbine. Why couldn't we go back to water power? Instead of looking at Niagara Falls, why don't we use it to churn electricity? It probably does already. Instead of looking at the Hudson River, why not use the Hudson River's natural flows to generate electricity? I saw a wonderful show a few months ago about some creative geniuses who were talking about putting in wind vanes, underwater wind vanes, underneath the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. Because the Venturi force of the tides is so great here. It's so strong because it's a little bottleneck that when the tides come in, anyone who sails knows this, sometimes you get 7, 8, or 8 knot currents that sailboats can't even drive against. They can't go against them. They wind up sitting under the bridge for hours till the tide changes if they're trying to come in or go out, whatever the case may be. But if they put little tunnels, big tunnels rather, underneath the surface of the water, I guess down on the bottom, and then they put, you know, propellers inside those tunnels, the water energy of the tidal change could generate electricity. So you say, well, it's not enough. It is enough. When you add it all up, wind and water and solar, these are the things this country should be investing billions of dollars in. You know, and of course, we all know about tightening up on the output of energy. We're all for that. Yeah, tell me about it the next time I go out in my twin diesel boat, because I'm not going to cut back on it. Sure, they come up with a green engine, I'll use it, but until they do, I'm not going to go to sailboats. I don't like sailboats. I own one. I never enjoyed it. I don't like the startup time, and I don't like tilting over in a sailboat. I don't like the tilt. I like engines. I've always liked engines, and I happen to love fast cars. I like big engines. I like the sound of big engines. And could you explain something to me about all the Prius drivers out there? Why are they such idiots? Why does every guy in a Prius have to speed and pass everybody and cut them off? It's sort of like the man with the small appendage who has to cut everybody off to show that he's as big as the big guy. They got to cut you off. You have a big, big car. They got to cut you off in the Prius. He's got to show you, oh, I'm just as fast. I may have a little car, but boy, it's not what you have. It's how you know, it's how you use it. It's so unbelievably blatant to me. You know, talk about, it's like horsepower envy. Freud would have called it something else, but it's a family show. We will call it horsepower envy that they're exhibiting. I'll take your calls. I have a question for you. Do you fear a collapse of the economic system? And what are you doing about it? What are you doing? Are you buying ready-to-eat meals, REMs? Have you stocked away gold REM? What do you, is it like? See, I don't want to go to the Y2K level on this show because I was against that. It's one of the reasons I survived in talk radio and became a national host and why others dropped out of the business, because I knew they were wrong. I knew that the Y2K predictors were wrong. Many of them were wrong on purpose. Some of them were just not clever enough to understand it was all hype. I'm not sure, though, that this economic crisis that we're in is going to go away. I'm not so sure I have faith in Henry Paulson and Mr. Bernanke. I'll be right back. Savage. Savage Nation. We're talking about this and that, the banking collapse, the fact that George Bush seems to be the socialist president of the very rich, while Obama would like to be the socialist president of the illegal alien and the very poor. But, you know, McCain gave a speech that is so shameful, it made my hair stand up. Listen to this. This is the La Raza. Yeah, listen to this. I have timing here on this show that anyone would be jealous of.
I know many of you were disappointed and hurt by those who used the debate on immigration last year, not to respectfully debate the issue as most did, but to denigrate the contributions of Hispanics to our great country.
Oh, get out of this. Get off the stage, you liar. Get off the stage, you old fraud, you. You old vaudevillian. I'm fed up with John McCain. That takes the cake. Who are you to tell us whether we should get angry about the 30 million illegal aliens in the country? We should be, be sedate about it. Be nice. You know, John, why don't you try going into an emergency room in a town instead of sitting on your fat butt and getting the care that the VA gives you or that the Senate affords you? Why don't you go into the emergency room the next time you slip and cut your hand open and then give me that rotten speech you just gave me? Go see them catering to them in every language under the sun except the language English. Go see a schoolroom, John, something you probably haven't seen in 75 years. Go take a look at what's inside your schoolrooms today. English as a second language. Where do you think the money is going, John? Teaching in every language except English, for God's sakes. Don't tell us we shouldn't get angry. We're more angry at politicians, John, than we are at the illegals. I actually don't blame the illegals. If they have a bunch of gangsters like you in power pandering to them, why wouldn't they come over the border and get free medical care and free health care? I don't blame them. No, it's we the people who are being ripped off by guys like you, John, and Obama, on which point, by the way, there's no difference. Both Obama and McCain are twins when it comes to granting amnesty to illegal aliens. Make no mistake about it. There is no difference between them on that particular issue. Now, what do the illegals have to do with the meltdown of the banking system, if anything? Can you blame it on them? Sure, you want the connection? Because I'm the only one in the talk radio landscape who sees the connection. Would you like to have it? Well, I've given it to you for 6 months now. I'll give it to you again since I've gotten your attention. I want you to turn the clock back 2 years. I want you to go back to the age when the Jesse Hijacksons of the world were screaming about greenlining and warning banks that they'd be sued, and how various civil rights racketeers, including some racketeers in La Raza, were threatening banks with major lawsuits if they did not lend money to more Hispanics. And, of course, you know the banks were not allowed to look into not only whether or not the individual applying for the mortgage was here legally or illegally, they weren't even allowed to look into whether or not they had an income. All that matters is that all that mattered at the time to the pressure groups like La Raza and the other pressure groups was that a certain number of Hispanics, a certain number of folks of other racial persuasions were given loans proportionate to their representation in the United States of America, irrespective of whether they could qualify for the mortgage. Now, I want to remind you of something, John McCain, something you don't know about, because you married rich very young. You were very, very smart to marry a beer heiress. And I don't mind you did that. But you never had to worry about money, John. When I bought my first house, it was $45,000, John, and I had to put down 20%. The bank wouldn't accept 18%. They wouldn't accept 19%. They wouldn't accept 19.8%. They wanted $9,000, not $8,500. And I had no beer heiress to go to, John. And I bought my first house with $9,000, John. And I was not an illegal alien.
Savage.
By
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I know many of you were disappointed and hurt by those who used the debate on immigration last year, not to respectfully debate the issue as most did, but to denigrate the contributions of Hispanics to our great country. I denounced those insults then, and I denounce them today.
And I denounce quislings like John McCain today and yesterday and tomorrow. Until John McCain stops pandering to illegal aliens, I denounce him. It's that simple. And I'm not going to vote for him. Now, I've had people come to me and say, Michael, come on, you don't want Obama to win. Well, to be honest with you, if they're both the same on so many issues, I don't think it matters which of the oligarchy, which of the oligarchs win. You know, they're front men. They're basically face players for the oligarchy. And it doesn't almost matter to me. The fact is we see that George Bush is a socialist. But he's not a socialist in the tradition of a red beret and a red flag. He's a socialist wearing a green beret and waving the flag called green, the green of money. George Bush is a socialist of the very rich, the private Boeing jet crowd. They're the ones he wants to bail out and has bailed out. They're the ones he will not prosecute, but he will prosecute the middle management and those of you who, let's say, did not return library books. So what's the difference if you bail out the rich or bail out the poor? You're still a socialist. And McCain, I'm telling you, is exactly the same. McCain has the same mold because he comes from the same background, the same party. Convention to lure a flock of private jets. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Business Journal data today. Hundreds of high-ranking politicians, business execs, and other VPs will fly into the Twin Cities for the Republican National Convention this fall. Many of them won't be flying coach, says the article. Private jet and charter plane traffic is expected to rise, if not soar, in Minnesota during the convention and in one unusual way. This is very unusual, what I'm about to tell you. Newly announced regulations from the FAA demand that planes bound for airports within 10 miles of the convention stop first for security screening at airports in St. Cloud, Rochester, or Eau Claire, Wisconsin, from September 1 through 4. Now, that's very interesting because most private jets have no security screening at all, incidentally, which is one of the pleasures of flying on a friend's private jet. You don't feel like a like an illegal alien breaking into an airplane. You feel like an American citizen. I have nothing against screening, but they should direct it to the demographic that is involved with most terrorism in the world. They should be 90% of all the screening should be directed at one particular demographic only. Only one demographic. Not the Irish nun. Not the Chinese lady 90 years old in a wheelchair who I saw strip searched and crying. And her granddaughter crying, asking the big TSA goon, why are you harassing my grandmother? She's not a terrorist. And the goon, of course, had a almost gross, G-R-O-S-Z-like smile on his piggy lips as he continued to lift the 90-pound Chinese lady out of a wheelchair to look under her poor little blanket. No, you see, this is the kind of garbage that we hate. Because we know it's all a product of the John McCains and the Obamas of the world who are trying to be oh so fair to the terrorist, the would-be terrorist, the illegal alien, and make those of us who know what's right and wrong feel squeamish. But I will never feel squeamish when I know I'm right. I would like to see John McCain get squeamish the next time he panders to the illegal alien and gives the middle finger to the conservative who we cannot get elected without. Let me tell you right now, and I'll tell you again, John McCain cannot get elected without the conservative voter. Now, I don't know whether the conservative voter is going to come out and vote for him or not. I can't predict that. I do know this. He cannot win by pandering to La Raza and giving the middle finger to the Paul Revere Society. He cannot win by giving the middle finger to the conservatives and the evangelicals while pandering to the illegal alien. He cannot win. It's impossible. But that brings us back to the economic meltdown Is it the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning? Do you fear it? What are you doing about it? Chicago, Illinois, Sam, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please. Sam, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, Mike. I respect your opinion a lot. However, I think we won't be, you know, in a disaster. I think we're in a correction. All these bad banks, these bad loans, they just have to be corrected. As long as the politicians don't bail them out, I think this is healthy for our economy.
Well, that's interesting. And as long as the politicians don't bail them out, but Bush wants to bail out the banks, the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. He's the one who wants to bail them out.
And I think we should speak out.
Okay. Well, I don't know that we can correct it. I hope we can. Trust me, I'd rather see us correct it than see it, you know, burn out the economy. So I agree with you on that, but we can't say that everything's fine right now. And how do you trust a guy like Treasury Secretary Paulson, who in some ways got us into this mess? How do you trust a system that permits an Alan Greenspan to ignore all of the warnings for so many years while his wife, Andrea Mitchell, was prognosticating on television, supporting all of her husband's positions? We have a very deep problem. It's endemic to the system when you have a government media complex like this. I do hope we can fix it. In a few minutes, I did an earlier interview with Philip Carlo on a mafia family that is somewhat related to the gang that is running the economy. And I've said this and I mean it. Sure, we all worry about the tattooed, bald gangs running around the streets with AK-47s, as we should. But in a way, I'm more worried about the guys without tattoos, well, some of them are bald as well. They just don't have tattoos. They wear better suits, but they're on Wall Street. And they may be at certain country clubs, and maybe you meet them at Aspen. Maybe you meet them at the Bohemian Club or wherever. I certainly don't meet them at the Bohemian Club because I would never attend the Bohemian Club in the sense that if you are a true Bohemian, you don't need to go to the club. Only the schmucks who don't even know what it is to be an original thinker need to go to the Bohemian Club and put on a dress, you know, and act zany and roll in, you know, and urinate on each other, whatever they do. I mean, why would you want to join a club that acts like they're morons? But let's put that aside. What's important to know is that we may not have the faith that we need. Where's the J. Edgar Hoover when we need him? Where is he? Who do you trust in government? Name one person. I'll be right back to take your calls right here on the Savage Nation after the mafia interview.
Savage.
About organized criminals have intrigued the American public for decades. Shows like The Sopranos and movies like The Godfather add to the mystique of organized crime. Philip Carlo is the author of many bestsellers and has always written about the mob with a special insight. He joins us on the Savage Nation to talk about that in his new book, Gaspipe: Confessions of a Mafia Boss. Philip Carlo, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. It's really good to be here with you. I've been a big fan of you for a long time. I think you're one of the original tough guys.
Your books about the mafia take us deep into the actual people and their lives. How did you get so close without getting disappeared?
You know, this whole thing with me and the mafia and how I ended up writing books about the mafia is a story unto itself. It's very interesting, actually. As it happened, I was born in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. I think there were more serial killers per square block in Bensonhurst than anywhere else. All members of the Fry family lived there, from the bosses on down. Paul Castellano, the head of the Gambino family, his granddaughter was a schoolmate of mine and a girlfriend of mine. And we just accepted those people, that culture, that walk, that talk, as part of our everyday lives. Really nothing unusual. Coincidentally, Anthony Gaspipe Casso moved in the house next door to my parents, and he ended up becoming very friendly with my mom and dad. With he and his wife, Lillian, they vacationed together. They had Sunday dinners in our house.
Hmm.
Ultimately, he went on to become the head of the Lucchese crime family.
Wow.
Certainly one of the most successful, for want of a better word, and infamous families that ever existed.
Tell us about that family.
They were a byproduct of the Castle-Damar Wars, which took place in the 30s. And when the war was over and the body count stopped, Lucky Luciano thought it would be much better to stop leaving bodies all over the place. And they kind of structured the mafia in terms of competing / cooperating corporations. And they therefore formed the five families. The Lucchese's were one of the original five families. What made Anthony Casso so unusual was he was the go-to guy when somebody in another family wanted another member killed. In other words, when John Gotti wanted to kill Roy DeMeo, he went to Anthony Casso, and Casso did the job. Roy DeMeo murdered over 200 people, and they had to kill him. Gotti was not able to do it because Roy was so efficient at killing people. You couldn't get near this guy, but Anthony managed to get not only near him, but he managed to get him murdered. What also made Anthony unusual was the fact that he had a lot of FBI agents in his pocket and a lot of NYPD cops. The so-called mafia cop that were on trial last year for killing eight people worked for Anthony. In 1994, when he was first arrested after being on the lam for 2 years, I thought to myself, I've got to write this book. I thought there was a great story there. I sent a letter to him, and he agreed to do a book with me, and I began researching it. And finally, the book is just coming out, and the name of it is Gaspipe. His nickname was Gaspipe because when he used to crack people over the head with a gaspipe. He was probably one of the most feared killers the mafia ever had. He wasn't feared so much for some kind of out-of-control psychosis. He was feared because he was very cunning, because you never knew what he was thinking. And he just had that amazing Southern Italian cunningness that was very, very difficult to get around, overcome, deal with.
What's it like being so close to these killers?
In growing up in Bensonhurst, I knew killers all my life. I knew Sammy the Bull Gravano very well, Gerard Papa, another person that killed 38 people. And being with Anthony, talking with him, was, for me, more interesting than frightening. I felt like I was almost lucky to have privy to what was going on in his head. What I actually managed to do here is capture the essence of what a mafia boss is really like. I portrayed it with a sincerity that I don't think we've ever seen before. And that's only because he was sincere with me. And that's only because he happened to like my parents. He's very fond of my parents. All that played into it, and ultimately I managed to get this amazing in-depth portrayal of a mafia boss.
Well, how do they actually infiltrate the unions?
One of the things that the Lucchese's were particularly adept at was the infiltration of unions. This is one of the more insidious aspects of what they do. What they manage to guile, cunning, and brutality, to post their people inside the unions. Jimmy Hoffa was put in that position by the mafia. When he started making trouble for the people who gave him the job, they killed him. And that's pretty much the story, over and over and over again. They did the Longshoremen's Union, Carpenter's Union, you name it, they do it. The Laundry Union, people that provide the sheets for all the hotels in New York, they control that union. And what they managed to do is get access to the huge amounts of pension funds, which they invest and they outright steal it. And they're still doing it. You cannot put up a building in New York without paying a mafia tax for the concrete, the steel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Private sanitation. They own it. They control it in New York and most everywhere in the country.
What was the mafia's main role in bringing in narcotics to the United States?
The mafia essentially was the brain behind bringing large amounts of heroin in the country via Sicily, Marseille, from Afghanistan. They mechanized it, they trimmed the fat off of it, and they made it a very successful enterprise. The famous French Connection, involving 98 pounds of pure heroin, was in a way the beginning of what ended up becoming truckloads of heroin. It's just too much profit in drugs for them to ignore. Although, that was one of the contributing factors in a large degree to their downfall.
Well, why is that?
Because the jail sentences being dished out, being given, were so harsh that ultimately people decided to turn on their colleagues, one member turning on another member. Rather than go away for 4 years for selling a bag of white powder, they were giving up their cohort. And ultimately, there were dictates and mandates that you don't do it, you have to stop. But off the record, as they said, they all do it. Off the record, they're all still doing it. And on the record, it's contributing to their own demise.
How were you able to look beyond the brutality of the crimes to get to the story of really who these people were?
You know, this question of writing about monsters in a way where they stop becoming monsters and they stop becoming human beings is apparently a trait I have. I'm doing it over and over and over again. I did it with the Night Stalker, Richard, the serial killer in California. I did it with the Iceman, a mafia contract killer that killed over 200 people, and now a gas pipe. And I'm not necessarily patting myself on the back. What I'm saying is, You cannot sit down with a person like this or a story like this and have preconceived notions about evil, about psychopaths. You just have to listen to the real arc of the story. And the arc of the story always begins with their childhood and goes on to the former years. In Gaspipe, I was able to really get a handle on how he became what he became. What were the elements? Was there a culture at play? Was there a mindset at play? And yes, there was. What he wanted more than anything as a teenager was to be a made member of the mafia. For him, that was a doctorate degree. That was a seat on the stock exchange. And ultimately, that's what he got. And he rose quickly through the ranks because of his brilliance. And that's the word, brilliance, at crime, at hijacking, union infiltration, drugs. Anthony had four trawlers bringing in hundreds and hundreds of tons of marijuana initially. Then it became cocaine and all types of other drugs. He made a fortune doing that. In a sense, my approach to writing about these guys, writing about this culture, is I'm a stone-cold professional, and I'm not about to draw parallels between good or bad or bad or good. I just tell it like it really is and let the reader make up their mind.
Well, ultimately, what happened to Anthony Casso?
Ultimately, he was arrested after being on the lam for 2 years. After a year being incarcerated, he decided to cooperate with the government. I mean, I could write a book on the reason he did that alone. Suffice it to say, he felt he was betrayed by the Chin Gigante, who was the head of the Genovese crime family. Ultimately, he turned on him, and that spread out. What he did do, also, he said a lot of negative things about Sammy the Bull Gravano. When I say negative, Gravano killed more than 19 people, and the government didn't want to hear that. He had pled guilty to killing 19 people. He had gotten his freedom. And that Gravano was a drug dealer. And that Gravano killed a cop. And that Gravano did this, that, and the other thing. And rather than have Anthony Casso besmirch their star witness, they deep-six Anthony, and they reneged on the deal that they gave him. And right now, he's got 13 life sentences plus 466 years at Colorado Maximum Prison. He's 10 feet underground. He lives in a little room. He's out an hour a day. I think he's beginning to suffer a form of mental illness from this type of incarceration. Every day he looks in the mirror, and every day he hates himself for what he did. He blames his turning on the loss of his wife, his family. Told me that he was sure his father's rolling over in his grave because of what he did. A very unhappy man.
Philip Carlo, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Well, Michael, it was great being on with you. Your questions, as always, are very insightful. I look forward to doing more with you in the future. Take care, my friend.
Savage.
Remember during the Clinton administration, there was a very famous slogan, it's the economy, stupid. Well, guess what? It's the economy, stupid. Now, we thought that the Republicans would be fiscally conservative. Of course, we were lied to, set up and sold out by George Bush and his cronies. They were anything but fiscally conservative. I mean, we heard the liberals tax and spend, which they do. So the Republicans borrowed and spent, and now we're paying for that. So you have a choice between the tax and spend liberals or the borrow and spend Republicans. I'll let you decide which one is better for your children's future. On MichaelSavage.com, here are the stories. Treasury Secretary bailing out his friends, comma, says insider. Right top, socialists should be happy with Bush's bank bailout. Did Schumer bust the bank? McCain, I've earned Hispanics' trust. Maka Indians embrace whaling and defend culture. Talk of the town, New Yorker. Obama in a turban. And Mrs. Obama looking like Angela Davis with an AK. And next article down on the Michael Savage Straight Talk Unfiltered. Scarred soldier marries a sweetheart. Here's a man whose face was burned off as part of the British Expeditionary Forces in Iraq. And his girl stood behind him. I guess she's not one of those who needs to go to a club for some stranger. She loves the man. And I guess she'll even live with the man with the scarred face and burned head. It's unbelievable. What a love story that is. I don't think that's coming to a theater near you. Here's a big story. Karzai opposes U.S. use of Afghan soil against Iran. You know what I love about these guys in Iraq and Iran that we propped up and put in place so they can make themselves billionaires and their friends are billionaires with money in Switzerland? What I love about them is their audacity. You got to admire the audacity of this fraud Karzai, the stooge in Afghanistan, who's very happy to let our men be killed so that he could be king of Afghanistan and then has the audacity to say to us, but you can't use our soil in any attack against Iran. Do you believe this? Well, what do you think about Malaki in Iraq? I know his name is Malaki, but for the sake of interest and entertainment, I'll call him Mr. Malaki. Because Mr. Malaki of Iraq also is another fraud, propped up, another puppet of God knows which forces. And Mr. Malaki in Iraq has the nerve to tell us to get out of Iraq now that you've freed it for us to rip off the contracting dollars and pump the oil. It's unbelievable to me. Now, who do I blame for this? Who do I blame for this? The spineless government. Bush to lift offshore drilling ban, I agree with him. Of course, it'll do nothing because the frauds like Barbara Boxer will get up on their golden toilet seats and scream about the environment that she never walks in. The only environment that she walks in is a limousine that's bulletproof with security. That's the environment. Chicago Tribune editor, L.A. Times publisher resigned. It's about time. Tribune editor Anne-Marie Lipinski and Times publisher David Hiller resigned. His parent company, Tribune Company. Who are they fooling? What do you mean they're resigning? What's waiting for them? A job at the New York Times, which is also sinking? I love it. They're resigning on principle. What jobs are they going to go to? They could always teach at the Kennedy School of Misgovernment. But I think even the corridors must be filled with out-of-work newspaper editors and publishers looking for jobs with hats in hand, looking for a job in a university now. I think the halls must be – the halls of academia must be filled like the streets of Southern California are filled with people looking to get their money back out of a bank. It's the same kind of line, I imagine, outside of the Kennedy School of Government and other academic bastions with out-of-work editors and publishers looking for a job. 120,000 Brits annually die early from socialized medicine rationing. That's on michaelsavage.com. Making the World Safe for Theocracy, fabulous article by Michael Savage, and Hitler's coming here again. What an opportunity. He likes missiles, and he believes in the virgins. I'd put one and one together, come up with two. The man loves missiles, and he loves the 32 virgins waiting for him in heaven, and he's coming to speak here again and spread his hate. I wonder if Obama and McCain will talk about his rhetoric as poisonous and evil. Do you think that McCain would get as agitated over Ahmadinejad and his poisonous rhetoric about homosexuals and Jews in the West as he did about conservatives who believed in the rule of law? I kind of doubt it. I think McCain is a 14-carat phony, and I think that Obama is a 1-carat phony, if you want a comparison. What else do we have on michaelsavage.com? Debunking global warming comes out every day, more and more and more. The secret bailout of J.P. Morgan, great story. On the bottom right, we have a picture for you on michaelsavage.com of a man from the 1920s with a wheelbarrow filled with paper currency. And I'm saying it can't happen again. Can't happen again. Actually, my headline was different. It was, it can't happen here. For some reason, my webmaster is not getting my headlines, which I'll have to work on tomorrow. I'll take your calls. Bob in Chicago, welcome to the Savage Nation topic, please.
The home loan crisis, and I was calling Dr. Savage. I've never called a talk show before, but I had to call you to congratulate you. I spent over 20 years in banking. I left the industry about a year ago, and you mentioned earlier tonight when I was driving home that there are groups that have been pressuring banks to make loans into low-income areas.
Thank you. Yes, the groups like La Raza, groups like the NAACP and others that pressured bankers with threats of lawsuits if you didn't give loans to unqualified illegal aliens and minorities.
Doctor, there are a couple of other organizations, if I may mention them.
I'd love to learn. I'm always open to learning. What, name them.
I'm not an expert in the industry, but you're literally the first observer I've seen in the papers, television, radio to get at least part of this right. And there are really two of them, Doctor. There's one called the Community Reinvestment Act. It's actually federal legislation. It was passed in the 70s, and it relates to redlining. You mentioned that earlier.
Yes.
The CRA can actually put pressure on banks by limiting mergers. They can stop banks from opening branches in order to put the pressure on to make these loans. And then, of course, there are community groups. I think one that was active, although I've not heard from them a while, is called ACORN, which is a larger group. And there's nothing inherently wrong with lending into small-income, low-income communities, but these organizations, plus the federal government under CRA, were quite aggressive. It's not the only reason there were problems in those.
No, I understand. I never said it was the only reason, but it's part of the problem that nobody will touch. And I happen to know it because I keep going back to the fact that when I bought my first house, I had to come up with 20%, not 19, not 18, not 19.5. I had to put down $9,000 on a $45,000 house. I'm talking in 1974. It was every penny I had saved my entire life. We know that banks were forced to give loans to people who had nothing down and no qualifications to pay. And what they did was the Ponzi scheme, you're a former banker back, Bob, as the value of the house went up, they could borrow against the equity, and they were using basically borrowed money to live on.
Well, I congratulate you, sir. You are literally the first person in the media that I'm aware of that has touched on that subject.
Well, Bob, are you a former banker?
I am.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in another question, if you have the patience. How did you come to listen to my talk show in Chicago on WIND? Was it chance?
Oh, my. Interesting point. Actually, I was driving into Chicago on business, and I saw a billboard that said, AM 560, WIND, liberals hate us. And I decided I had to turn into that station, and that's the station I listen to you on now. And I've
Isn't that interesting? Well, that's great. I'm glad that they're using a billboard campaign to wake up the general listener to the fact that there's more out there than what you get on ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox News. Bob, thank you. As a former banker, I always appreciated the educated caller. But let's not lose the fact that this man just presented. He's reinforcing my opinion, which is factually based. All of my opinions are factually based, incidentally. No matter how rhetorically offensive they may be to you, or no matter how agitated you may think I sound and emotional, it doesn't matter. If you actually analyze what I'm saying, you'll find that my Platonic logic or my Aristotelian logic is as hard as mathematics itself. If you break down the words, you'll find out that what I'm telling you has validity in almost every case, except when I'm pulling your leg, which is very rarely. I have told you that part of the banking crisis is directly related to groups like La Raza, a group that McCain and Obama is pandering to. Groups like La Raza threaten banks with lawsuits if they did not lend money to a certain number of individuals who they considered to be part of their constituency, meaning Hispanics only. They didn't lobby on behalf of white people without money. Now, I want you to ask yourself a question. Do you think La Raza ever went to a bank and said, if you don't lend money to poor white people and poor Hispanic people and poor black people and poor Asian people, we will bring a lawsuit? No. No, they represent the race, a race. Now, Obama today said that it means the people, but you know he's a rhetorician. There's a better word for it than rhetorician, because all politicians are really not rhetoricians. They're sophists. A sophist is different than a rhetorician, but I don't want to go into splitting hairs with you. And don't confuse sophists with sophisticates or sophistication. Although in some way there's a relationship between sophism and sophistication. You know, it's called putting on airs and BSing the public, throwing the malarkey, as my father would say. He forced me to stick to whatever I said to that man. I'm an immigrant's son. And whatever I said to that man, God, did it have to take the test of this guy. He wouldn't let me get away with a smidgen of wiggle room. He didn't know about wiggle room. The world he came from, if you said something wrong, your life depended on getting it just right. The world he came from and the world he had to inhabit, the struggles that he had. I guess you had to be real honest or you didn't get anywhere. At least that's the way he got through life. He didn't ever rob a penny from anyone. He had a few rules in his little store, which was, never lie to a customer and always give them the money back if they're unhappy, which I never saw happen in all the years he had his store. He never gave money back. No one ever asked him for it. He never cheated anybody. So he lived by a simple policy of be honest, but those days are gone to a certain extent. Not all businessmen lie. Don't be ridiculous. I found the opposite to be true. The wealthiest men I know are the most honest men I know, incidentally. The wealthiest men I know are the most honest. They provided products that people wanted, and people beat a path to their door. Remember the old adage when you were a kid? If you build a better mousetrap, people will beat a path to your door. It's still true. It's still true. You don't have to be a liar and a thief to get rich in America. Only on Wall Street does that apply. On Wall Street, you have to be a liar and a thief to get ahead. You have to have an innuendo campaign against your competitors so that their stock tanks. And then you could pick at their assets like a vulture. That's what happened to Bear Stearns. And, of course, the people who picked at their assets are the survivors, and, in fact, they're the ones who should be investigated. This is considered by insiders the greatest theft in the history of America. What has happened on Wall Street, particularly what happened a couple of months ago at Bear Stearns, and who came out on top, this is considered the greatest theft in the history of American finance. And they only took in a few of the mid-managers. The top guys traded in their Gulfstreams for Boeing business jets converted. They did so well that they were able to give away their Gulfstreams to their maids. They did so well that they were able to give away their Gulfstreams to their gardeners. They did so well that they have orders for an MD-80 that they can't even fulfill. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. I see that another low-life actress has gotten arrested, you know, let out of jail. It's sort of like the civil rights protesters and the peaceniks, that their cachet amongst their friends goes up if they get arrested and get out of jail, like, in a few minutes. Seems that the actresses now have to show up, like, you know, every other day they have to act like Amy Winehouse, whoever that dirtbag junkie is. She's another one, you know, has to go to jail. And Angelo Jolie needs a baby a day. I think that girl needs to either adopt or have a baby every month to stay in the news. Either they're getting arrested or getting pregnant or adopting. I never saw anything like this. Anything for attention. You talk about narcissism. How does Brad Pitt, how does he live with that woman? How does he live with that woman? There must be a word for a woman like this who either adopts babies from the third world or has babies. Now, I know that there's a blank maniac who needs endless amounts of sex. Is this like a babomaniac? No, that wouldn't work, because then it could apply to the person herself. Infantomaniac? Would that work? Is there a psychiatrist in the house? What would you call someone who could... A fetomaniac? No, that would be a fetus only. Adoptomaniac? No, because it's not only adopting. Now she's having them. I guess they banned her in the third world. She was scarfing up so many babies from the third world, they banned her. I think they stopped her from going to certain regions in Southeast Asia. Everywhere she went, people lost their children. She came home with more children. What do they do with them? They're like puppies. Isn't there like an illness that you need, that she's collecting babies? Like people have cats, like 35 cats, 40 cats. How do you raise so many children? I don't know. I come from a different time and a place, which is you don't collect children like pocketbooks or pointy shoes in a closet. You know, you want to raise a child, that's tough. It's 24/7 for the rest of your life. Till you go in that oxygen tent or the box, it's your problem. And if you're not thinking about your child that often, you're probably a rotten parent. I remember in the 70s, there were bumper stickers that went around. I thought they were cute. My kids were very young at the time, but I looked at it, I didn't understand it. I drove a broken old Volvo at the time, a stick shift 4 on the floor, and once a guy cut me off and I tried to catch up with him, and he went shooting past me, and then we caught up each other at a light, and he said to me, just before the light turned green, he said, "Hey, buddy, if you want to race, you better get a faster car," and he shot away. I got so mad, but of course it was an old diesel Volvo. I couldn't catch up with him. I got so pissed off that I got a better job and bought a new car. Well, that's what you're supposed to do when you feel like you're downtrodden. You're supposed to buckle down, get smarter, work smarter, make more money, and get a faster car. You're not supposed to kill anybody. You're not supposed to be resentful and ask somebody to slow the other guy down. Like, see, the guys in the Prius actually are mad that you're faster than them. That's why they always cut you off. I don't mind the Prius. Drive it. But you don't have to have an attitude like you're a stunt job, like you got a stunted guy, you know, like a midget, or somebody who was like, you know, dealt a bad card that you have a little car. You resent the guy with the faster car, don't you? So you're saying, I'm holier than you. My car is more fuel efficient, so you have no right to pass me. You have no right to be faster than me. I want to control you through the government. I want all cars that are not, you know, like my car stopped. You shouldn't be able to make them. Well, okay, good luck. That's the same thing with the cartoon about Obama with the turban and Mrs. Obama looking like Angela Davis with the afro and the AK. I've told you 1,000 times, I put it on my CD, the best-selling CD about the First Amendment. The First Amendment was written by the founding fathers to protect offensive speech, not to protect polite speech, John McCain. Not to protect polite speech, Barack Obama. Not to protect polite speech, Nancy Pelosi. The First Amendment was written to protect offensive speech and to permit offensive cartoons, you schmuck. Now, if this schmuck, John McCain, is no different than Obama on a thing as fundamental as the First Amendment and the New Yorker cartoon, then what is the big difference then? He wants to be like Teddy Roosevelt. He's not acting like Teddy Roosevelt. He's acting like Eleanor Roosevelt. You can write that one down. You can write that one down. If John McCain acted like Teddy Roosevelt, he would have had my vote 6 months ago. But this guy is acting day after day more like Eleanor Roosevelt than he is like Teddy Roosevelt. You can mark that one down. And the same guy who would like to be Paul Revere, who stole it from me. By the way, if I were a cartoonist, what I would do is I'd picture him with his legs wrapped around the tube of a private jet, smoking a big cigar on flyover country, with Dick Cheney and George Bush inside the jet in the window high-fiving each other. Rather than jet fumes coming out of the tail of the jet, I would have something else dropping down on flyover country. But that's just a fantasy of mine. No, the issue is John McCain saying that the cartoon of Obama as wearing a turban and Mrs. Obama with the afro and the AK is offensive. It's supposed to be offensive, you idiot. That's what a caricaturist is supposed to do. Provoke reaction, schmuck. That's what talk show hosts are supposed to do. Provoke thought. Provoke reaction, schmuck. We're not supposed to be smooth jazz. We're supposed to be John Coltrane. We're supposed to make the audience cry and laugh and be moved, schmuck. That's what art is. That's what poetry is, schmuck. It's not supposed to be smooth jazz. It's supposed to be jazz. It's supposed to be jazz. You're supposed to hear us and be reactive to us. You're supposed to hear us and be moved by us one way or the other, John. And if you find it impolite, the cartoon of Obama, it's too damn bad. You live in America. You don't live in Syria, John. And if you start to sound more like Eleanor Roosevelt than you do like Teddy Roosevelt, I got news for you, John. There's a Buick dealership in Mongolia waiting for you.
Savage.